Welcome to The Cauldron, the podcast where history simmers with meaning. In this episode, we turn to the storied shores of Canada's West Coast, where tradition, power, and ceremony converge in one of the most profound cultural institutions of the Indigenous people of the Pacific Northwest, the potlatch. Join us with Dr. Barry Goff, one of Canada's foremost maritime and imperial historians. With his deep understanding of the colonial frontier and Indigenous European relations, Dr. Goff takes us into the heart of a ceremonial world often misunderstood, repressed, and ultimately revived. A world where wealth is given, not hoarded, and where social order is reinforced through oratory, song, and ancestral rites. In this episode, we explore the origins of the potlatch, its central role among nations such as the Nechalnith and the Tlingit, and the fierce cultural resistance that followed the federal potlatch ban of 1885. We'll hear how this institution survived, hidden or transformed, and how today it stands out not just as a cultural revival, but as a political act of identity and resilience. Stay with us as Dr. Goff brings his historian's eye and storyteller's voice to the firelight of the potlatch. This is The Cauldron.
Today I'm speaking about the potlatch, which is a persistent and living feature of Northwest Coast Indigenous life. It's been something that has been prominent in the history of coastal First Nations, British Columbia, Alaska, and Washington State for a very long period of time. It rose to prominence in the last half of the 19th century, and we now know that it was based on earlier practices of these various nations and bands and tribes. It has been studied extensively by noted anthropologists, Franz Boas of Columbia University, and his assistant George Hunt, who was from Fort Rupert, Vancouver Island, which features in our account today. And it was later studied by none other than Claude Lévi-Strauss and Ruth Benedict and many, many others. Colleagues of mine, Douglas Cole, Wayne Suttles, Ira Jackness, have all studied the experience and the records of the missionary societies, the Department of Indian Affairs that are published in the sessional papers, the photographs, the mission records, the museum records, and so forth. I myself have studied the story of the Reverend Hall and his wife Elizabeth Thimbleby, who went to Fort Rupert, where the Kwakwaka'wakw people were, and they went there in 1878. They were the first of the missionaries. Now, as we've said on other occasions in the podcast series, the missionaries were revolutionary. They were bringing missionary revolutionary ideologies to people who already had their own ways of celebration and their own features of the other world and its instincts, its beliefs, its practices, its legends, and so forth. This is the study of the potlatch is an exciting one. It is unique, although there may be parallels elsewhere in the world, but it is so famous that it has become integral to the history of British Columbia. It has important legacies. It has a persistence, as I said, that continues to this day. It involves anthropologists. It involves museums. It invites an analysis of the question of stolen properties. And it invites the question of the reclamation of those quote-unquote stolen properties and the establishment of Indigenous museums in certain cases. The Kwakwaka'wakw speaking peoples have their own near Fort Rupert and Alert Bay. Indigenous characteristics of the time and even perhaps today are as follows. First of all, there's the question of rank. And there were three classifications of persons. There were the chiefs, then there were the commoners, and then there were the slaves, arguably 10% of the population. The largest quotient were the commoners, and the minority, though the most powerful in rank, were the chiefs. And the chiefs had control of the customs and the traditions and the legends and the naming principles of the people of their bands. Secondly, it's a question of possession. Who holds not only the physical properties of place and of trade and of totem poles, or poles, if you wish to call them that, house fronts and so forth, but included in their possession were stories, legends, knowledge and of the supernatural and the natural worlds. Now, these two of rank and possession come together in the transfer of names and of titles. The reinforcing of traditions is everywhere apparent in the potlatch. Names had certain value to that society, to those bands, to those fraternities or indigenous collectivities, and they were prized possessions. There was also an inter-village rivalry that was very extensive, and the rivalry may well have gone on within the individual villages, but the visual and historical records seem to indicate that the rivalries existed between one nation or village and others, nations and villages that were invited to a potlatching feast. And the whole principle was the accumulation of wealth and then the giving it away. And this, we might say in common parlance, is we can do better than you can, or to put it on another way, it's a bit of one-upmanship. But in terms of the anthropological record and the great studies that have been done, we know that the amassing of wealth and the creation of piles and piles of, say, bags of flour or Hudson Bay Company blankets, or on the ground, large bowls or pieces of copper, as another example of the many things that were given away. If you could give it away, then you challenged other participants or invitees to the potlatch to do better. And so there was in the world of the 19th century and in the early 20th century, this huge amassing of wealth and possession of property by individual bands and nations on the coast. And then the invitation would go out for a potlatch to be held on such and such a day or during a few days. And the invitation would be responded to by the amassing of all the visitors at such a place as Alert Bay or Fort Rupert or Blunden Harbor, to give you three examples. So the collection of material objects and giving them away was the nature of the potlatch. Now, as you can imagine, perhaps with some knowledge of missions history yourself, that the idea of missions was not to give things away, but to save them and to pass them on with prudence to survivors. But in the 19th century also, there were people like Samuel Smiles, an Englishman, who believed that the collection and the saving of items was really important to a prudent life. He was also, of course, interested in other things, but saving of material things and the acquisition and control of wealth was important. But with the Northwest Coast people, you see, it's just exactly the opposite. I think this is an important feature. Thus, when the missionaries, like the Reverend Hall and his wife, came to Fort Rupert, they found that they were facing a society which was quite indifferent to the coming of the Church of England and its Church Missionary Society and Christianity as in general. And indeed, it was the older chiefs who were the ones who resented the imposition or the attempted imposition by members of the Church Missionary Society representing the Anglican Church or the Church of England. So you can see that people like Reverend Hall and his wife, in their reports to London, to the CMS headquarters, would say, you know, here are people who are incorrigible. That was a famous term that the missionaries used to like to talk about in description of the people who were engaging in the potlatch. And there are stories, of course, by the fact that these people had a very complicated language, Kwakwaka'wakw being extremely difficult. And some missionaries had tin ears. In the case of the Reverend Hall, he found it extremely difficult to learn the language. But when Elizabeth joined him after their marriage, she was quite attuned to their possibilities. Now, a missionary among such people as the Kwakwaka'wakw or Kwakiutl would want to have the Lord's Prayer. They would want to have some Gospels. They would want to have some Psalms, and they'd want to have an ability to tell the story of Jesus and the rise of Christianity. But they found with the Kwakwaka'wakw, that Kwakiutl, that this society was growing so rich and so strong at the very same time that they were coming to try to preach the gospel and make conversions, an absolutely head-on circumstance. So that's the background, the central background of this extraordinary conflict that went on in the late 19th century. It's extraordinarily extraordinarily interesting, and has attracted every student of anthropology in Canada who, even at an undergraduate level, will have been introduced to this important tradition and important practice. Now, Franz Boas came into the lands of the Kwakiutl in the 1880s and 1890s. And his transcription of Kwakiutl is that they were meaning the ancient smoke, that is referring collectively to the Fort Rupert tribes, the composition of which has changed over time, but includes the following: the various tribes and subgroupings that are part of the rich tradition. Within the people, the Kwakiutl people, there were these other groupings, and they were all rivals. Now, in our study of the evolution of colonial development and the exercise of strength by the Hudson Bay Company and the Royal Navy in the form of trading practices and the following on by the Royal Navy with gunboats, we know that the Fort Rupert peoples consisted of two different tribes or entities. And indeed, James Douglas's agents had signed independent treaties with two different groupings at Fort Rupert. Now, we also know that these people had come to Fort Rupert from other more distant locations with the opening of the Hudson Bay Company's coal mining operations and commercial activities at Fort Rupert. It was therefore that Fort Rupert becomes the first of these modern locations for the Kwakiutl. And there are others, as I mentioned before. But after Fort Rupert at Beaver Harbor, Vancouver Island, closes down and the Nanaimo gold fields are developed dramatically, the movement to find another location occurs when some Americans decide to establish a salmon cannery operation at a place called Alert Bay. on Village Island. So the Fort Rupert people shift their attention there, also to Malcolm Island, I should add. And these this becomes a common place for visiting by inland steamers, and goes on right through through to the 1970s when my parents visited that particular location. It's very, a very, very famous place. Now, the legends of these people were recorded by Franz Boas's assistant, George Hunt. George Hunt was, you would call him Métis. Others would call him mixed blood. He had a Scottish parent and a Kwakiutl parent. So he was wonderfully disposed to, because he had English as well as the native language, to take down these traditions and stories by the great from the great people of Fort Rupert, and particularly of Alert Bay. There is an extraordinarily rich photographic history that can be told of the Potlatches as well. When the gunboats made their visits, when the trading ships made their visits, there were wonderful photographers, very highly capable people. The history of photography goes to the 50s when the daguerreotypes are introduced, but they're very, very primitive. Then come the great plates process, and by the 1890s, we get wonderful photographers coming from museums who take these fabulous photographs of potlatches at such places as Alert Bay. There are numerous examples of this. In the American Museum of Natural History, you might see something in which there are Hudson Bay Company blankets piled up in the Great House. There will be others in which the bowls are laid out in front of a great house. There are others in which blankets and other things are piled up in great number, flour in bags, as I mentioned before. Now, let's go on to the attempted suppression of the Potlatch. And our main argument here, those of us who have studied this and taught it about its features, are that it was persistent, that it was attempted to be suppressed, and that is particularly the case in the Cramner Potlatch of the early 1920s, but that it went underground and that it had surfaced again, and after 1945 became a persistent way of practice without any criminal intent. But after the Cramner Potlatch, a number of chiefs were sent to a prison in British Columbia, and then eventually released. The judicial processes, including that of Matthew Bailey Begbie, were that it was impossible to render judgments in this case, and it was better to allow the Northwest Coast people to pursue the Potlatch in their own simple way. And indeed, this was very much the case until Duncan Campbell Scott comes on the scene, and he's the great suppressor. He comes out of the Indian Department and becomes, of course, later a famous poet. But his influence in the suppression or attempted suppression of the Potlatch is part of the story. I'm not going to feature it here in this discussion, but I want to go back to 1885, because it was in that year, in consequence of the pressures of the various missionary societies and the government and the Indian agents, Israel Wood Powell, Dr. Israel Wood Powell, was the Indian agent and commissioner appointed by Sir John A. Macdonald in the 1870s. His influence was important in sending descriptions to Macdonald and to others in the departments in Ottawa of what was going on in these ceremonial practices. Thus it was that in 1885, the government of Canada of Sir John A. Macdonald outlawed the potlatch at the instigation of British Columbia Indian agents, missionaries, and indeed, important to note, a few Christianized Indians. The reasons behind the ban, according to Douglas Cole, are as follows. First, there was the concern with health. 2 months of nightly winter feasting, with families moving from village to village in temporary housing, and this made sickness and exposure inevitable, especially among children. Second, the potlatch encouraged prostitution of Native women as a source of potlatch funds. We have knowledge of the fact that the chiefs sent their multiple wives to places like Fort Victoria and Victoria, where they engaged in prostitution. Then thirdly, there are certain subordinate reason was that schools could not flourish when the winter was given over to endless shifting celebrations. There's an example of this with the Reverend Hall. He gets ready for Christmas or pre-Christmas celebrations and discovers that the whole village has gone over to Knight Inlet because the salmon are running there. So the missionaries wanted stable, permanent locations where, in fact, the indigenous people were mobile and in their canoes and following the seasons in their own way. A fourth economic reason was doubtless the most important. I referred to this earlier. The system was based on the hoarding of goods, not for saving and investment, but for seemingly senseless waste. I quote an Indian commissioner, "It is not possible that Indians can acquire property or become industrious with any good result while under the influence of this mania," that is to say, the hoarding of goods. Potlatch was not only a waste of time, but a waste of resources and was incompatible with the government's goal of Indian economic and social progress. Now, we have this as early as 1885 and outlawed at the very same time as the outlawing of the potlatch was something which was called the Tamanawas dance or the Hamatsa or cannibal ritual of the Kwakiutl winter ceremonies. There has been a huge discussion about whether or not cannibalism existed among the Fort Rupert Kwakwalawak, or it was just an ingestion and then an exodus of the flesh. I leave that for your consideration. But the government, in passing the legislation in 1885, acted on the best available advice to it, not just that of missionaries, but men such as Sproat, the ethnologist George Mercer Dawson, George Blenkinsop, who was formerly an employer of the Hudson Bay Company, whose judgments were based upon close observation, long personal experience, and a desire to advance the conditions of the Indians. This is an important point to note because from our perspective, in which colonization is decried as something which we would like to forget. But it was the matter that the persons who were in power in government in Ottawa, representing members of parliament from across the country, were interested in the improvement and civilization, according to their way of thinking, of the indigenous persons. But most of the information that was coming from the frontier, from the far western frontier, showed that the Indians were unpersuaded in making a social change such as this. As Cole puts it, the great majority wanted to continue their customary potlatch and could see no reason not to do so. They saw it as their oldest and best festival, one that sustained their property, rank, and marriage arrangements. It was an innocent pastime, said one. It was their winter amusement that worked for the benefit of the old and for the destitute. Certainly for societal integration. Above all, they appealed to fairness. The law was simply unjust, they said. We believe it is our right just as much as it is the right of our white brethren to make presents to one another. Although they wished to live within the law, they were prepared to ignore this one and, if necessary, to defy it. Now, that comes from the Department of Indian Affairs files. Everywhere on the coast, reports of Indian opinion was the same. The Vancouver Island New Chalmers would have to be educated before they could see its folly. The Cowichan said the government was wrong in preventing the potlatch. The Kwakiutl had doubts about it being done away with. The first showdown between Indian opinion and government enforcement occurred among the Cowichan Salish. Now, it so happens, therefore, that we get this pull and this push within the individual coastal Indian peoples themselves. Some are prepared to go along with the new change. Others are more resistant. It seems to be a correct observation. It was the older chiefs who were afraid of losing rank, privilege, and status who were the most opposed to the potlatch, but the younger persons who were now entering the commercial economies of the coastal peoples and coastal society were the ones who were more agreeable or accepting of the changes which the missionaries and the governments were bringing forth unto them. But in any event, the first arrests begin to occur. In 1889, there was a agent by the name of Pidcock, who successfully, after an event, arrested a potlatcher at a village island. The case went for trial in Victoria before Matthew Bailey Begbie, and throwing the case out of court on a technicality, Sir Matthew went on to cast doubt about the law itself. The statute did not define potlatch, he said, and if Parliament wanted to create a new offense, previously unknown in law, then it should be defined. And Begbie's point of view was shattering. The law was a dead letter, as the Indian agent put it. Nonetheless, despite the legal implications of this ruling on the spot, or the unfulfilling of the court case, Ottawa did not attend to these points of view, and they went on increasingly in the points of view of following the Indian agent on the spot, who was opposed to the potlatch and representing Duncan Campbell Scott's point of view. So we get a man by the name of Vowell, V-O-W-E-L-L, the Indian agent, who presses strongly in the late 1890s against the potlatch. And Duncan Campbell Scott in Ottawa listens to this point of view and agrees with it completely. Then we get, of course, the publications of Franz Boas coming on the scene at this very point in time in 1898. He wrote that all about the ceremonial activities, the shaking of the ground, the family histories as recorded, the privilege of doing potlatching to recognize names and titles and privileges coming down through. And so this is to some degree reinforcing of the knowledge that the Department of Indian Affairs has about what is going on the spot. Now, later on, the Department of Indian Affairs sends their own anthropologists out to the coast to do their own studies. But nonetheless, the die is cast. And in this growth of the idea of that Canada is going to be a new reformed country, and it's going to be a bi-national country of English and French, and that there's going to be improvement for the Indigenous people under the provisions of the Indian Act, the tendency to for enforcement and eradication of Native privileges and potlatching or sun dance, for that matter, in the prairies is an ongoing and important feature. So by the turn of the century, the process for continuing the strengthening of the rules and regulations against the carrying out of the potlatch comes forward. Now, to conclude on this theme, during the First World War and of the period of the First World War and towards the year 1920, 1921, 1922, the enforcement procedures are strengthened. So in some cases, we know that the chiefs agreed to this process and, in fact, issue statements abhorrent of the old practices. They are the modernists who have been either convinced to change their points of view or have been enforced to change their points of view. But when the Dan Cranmer potlatch occurs, the possessions and the regalia of the potlatchers is taken away. The enforcement of it, including the imprisonment of a good number of indigenous persons, is the crowning moment or the high point of the enforcement procedures, and it begins a period of time that really goes on for almost 20 years until 1945, when the potlatch has a revival because the government of Canada decides that it can't enforce these regulations and shouldn't in the first place, but should allow the indigenous practices to continue. By this time, the strength of the indigenous villages had weakened greatly. The numbers had gone down and then had been revived, but the old traditions were passing away. Thus it was that this was the period of time in which the potlatch went underground. As I said previously, it had later resurfaced. It's carried on to this day. There's still the exchange of titles, names, possessions, practices, privileges, legends, and a reaffirmation of the village peoples. Now, among the great collections of the indigenous regalia and masks and individual artistic creations, the American Museum of Natural History in New York became one of the great repositories of this material. The British Columbia Museum also acquired these things. In the 1960s, the University of British Columbia, under its great program that was developed there, began to collect Kwakwaka'wakw regalia and masks in great number. And if you go to that wonderful museum on Point Grey in Vancouver, you will find on display some of these great masks. And video production has also recorded the nature of these particular people. You will perhaps know of the video footage that was done by Curtis in the Land of the War Canoes, which is one of the first films that was done of the people of Alert Bay and the Kwakwaka'wakw peoples themselves. Then in addition to that, there's the collection of masks at the Royal British Columbia Museum and in other museums as well. And not least, of course, is UMISTA, which is the museum of the Kwakwaka'wakw people that exists at Alert Bay, a wonderful place indeed. So to conclude, we have here a collision of civilizations, of the Euro-American civilization exhibited by Canada, also by the Church Missionary Society, also in the form of Indian agents specifically and missionaries, but also an incursion for discovery purposes of the great anthropologists, Franz Boas, and his various acolytes who came after him. We have a historical representation of him in a biography, and George Hunt, who I mentioned earlier, a biography is available of him too. He's an important go-between person, in increasingly of value for those persons who are studying this. But the photographic record, the museum's collections, are rich, and they are famous, and they sit in a period which Douglas Cole called Captured Heritage. It's a wonderful book. It was the beginning point in which Indigenous people of the Northwest Coast, and particularly in British Columbia, began to clamor for the return of their properties to their own people for display and care. This has recently happened in the case of the Nootka with the Whaler Shrine, but in terms of the Kwakwaka'wakw speaking peoples, they have been very vigorous in their desire to get things returned. One is always struck by the fact of whether or not these are in fact stolen properties. I've wrestled with this many a time. I talked with Douglas Cole about the title, because indeed the First Nations were preparing regalia, poles, vestments, masks, and so forth for sale. And there were transactions that did occur. It's a cultural appropriation, yes, but looking on the very brightest side of this, which is hard to do in our own particular times, if we think about the fact that these things were saved for posterity and are now returned, then that's a very great triumph for the preservation of the traditions and the life mores and ways of persons who in the late 1880s were subject to the potlatch law. So the material culture and the photographic records are really a valuable way of seeing how a society passed from an earlier form to its present day form. One would be remiss if one did not acknowledge the fact that we're, the Indigenous people of the coast are living in the modern world, and they've made adjustments that are extraordinary and remarkable, but that they also retain their history of the potlatch, and it's the center point in their history, because around this is centered their names and their regalia and their kinship and their ties and their own village histories, which are very local. And as a champion of local history, I think that the study of people at, say, Fort Rupert or Alert Bay or Blunden Harbor, which had been visited by Emily Carr, to give you three examples, are just wonderful ways of inquiring into the nature of these people. The photographs of Curtis are remarkable too, though a little bit contrived, and the video footage is extremely remarkable. So that's it in a nutshell. I hope that this has enlarged your understanding of this incredible process. To me, it's been one of an enduring passion and interest. I was the first to look at the hall papers in the records of the Church Missionary Society and to write up that story in a publication of the Anglican Church of Canada, which is available online. So I'm Barry Goff, and I'm signing off. And please stay tuned for more episodes in the Cauldron series, sponsored by CanadaHistorySociety.ca. Signing off, Barry Goff.